panel in a few minutes' time. Britain, of course, has been deeply involved in the history of Iraq in both the 20th and 21st century. The Second Iraq War still haunts us in this country, and it's hardly necessary to emphasize that after the vote in the House of Commons, which I think was profoundly motivated by reflections on the Iraq War. I don't wish to make a political point, but I think the very fact that Mr. Blair came and appeared and argued so much for approving a military intervention in Syria actually was quite counterproductive in a sense, because people were so conscious of the Iraq War and its legacies. The Second Gulf War, I think, has few friends in this country today. Talk about the fledgling democracy, the new Iraq, sound to many of us a bit hollow, and whatever gains there have been, it seems to have been at an enormous price in terms of human life. I remember at the start of the Second Iraq War going to an Iraqi wedding in London, and I was rather sceptical about the war, but I asked my Iraqi host, how many people in this room, and there were about 300 people in the room, are in favour of this military intervention in Iraq? And he replied, 100%. A few years ago, I asked him, what proportion of that wedding guest list do you think are now in favour of the war in Iraq? And he thought probably less than 10%. Certainly there'd been a huge swing in opinion. Today, we, I think, get rather superficial news reports about what is happening in Iraq. We hear of the number of people who have been killed, and the number being killed in the last month was truly horrifying. We hear the odd report of a bomb explosion here, but we don't really get very profound or very detailed reporting. But the future for Iraq is still there to be argued for, to be fought for peacefully, and I think BC has a very important role in promoting scholarship, promoting academic exchanges, promoting much more knowledge of what is going to happen, and I hope all of us will learn, as I'm sure we will, a huge amount from this conference in the next few days. So thank you very much all for coming, and please enjoy the conference very much, and I now hand over to Sir Adam Roberts.
Ladies and gentlemen, a very warm welcome to you. I'm delighted to welcome you on behalf of the British Academy, the institution next door where the conference will actually be in the next 2 days. And, of course, on behalf of the principal instigating body behind this conference, the British Institute for the Study of Iraq. Brackets Gertrude Bell Memorial, unbracket, is its full title, and I'll say a word more about Gertrude Bell in just a moment. First, some parish pump simplicities. Please, if you've got a mobile phone here, make sure that whatever else it's doing is absolutely silent and preferably off. Secondly, I have invited all the speakers on the panel to be relatively brief in their initial remarks in order that there be plenty of time for discussion. And I hope they will forgive me if I start gesticulating if they are into injury time, because I think the discussion is often the most interesting part of meetings of this kind. There will be roving microphones in the discussion period, and we will finish at about 8 when there will be drinks available in the room next door. I just want to give some idea now about what this panel is about. It's a public event prior to the conference. This might sound like a case of Alice in Wonderland, sentence first, verdict afterwards. in the sense that the conference will go into depth in some of these questions, but there are very interesting and important issues that I think we can and should explore today about the occupations of Iraq, and particularly important issues arising and being thought about much at this 10th year anniversary after the invasion. So the emphasis of this panel will be more contemporary than historical, although with some reflection on how the histories of these two countries, the United Kingdom and Iraq, have been so intertwined and with such very mixed results for both sides. We'd like to encourage a lively debate about the kind of politics that British occupations of Iraq encouraged and gave rise to. There are many rather depressing parallels between the two events in the 1920s and in the last decade. Depressing for what they tell us about our political class, our prejudices, our understanding of the use of armed force, and maybe about ourselves generally. These occupations of Iraq were productive of violence and privilege in Iraq, with which Iraqis themselves are now having to cope. I don't want to force the parallels in any narrow sense. History may leave its mark, but doesn't repeat itself exactly. Nevertheless, they may provoke us. And it is, of course, a striking fact about much of the discussion prior to the 2003 invasion of Iraq that it significantly lacked a historical dimension. For example, in that discussion, the name and experience of Gertrude Bell in Iraq half a century earlier, or more than half a century earlier, was scarcely considered, no doubt deemed to be irrelevant because so long ago. And yet, there are significant parallels. Gertrude Bell certainly had a role in the creation of modern Iraq, and sent there in 1916, she had the glorious title given by the British Civil Service in anticipation of Edward Said, of Oriental Secretary. She commented, and this, I'm afraid, tells one something about the British view of Iraq, she commented that there were few wise people in Baghdad, i.e. people who want a British mandate. Funny that. And even more curious, it's still true that there aren't many people there who want a British mandate. In this, as in other observations, Gertrude Bell seems to have had that common colonial tendency to underestimate the nationalism of others. Still, she was perhaps wiser than Churchill, who sent a cable to Lloyd George in 1920, prospects Mesopotamia promising. Well, I'm not sure that prospects for Mesopotamia promising is any more true today than it was then. But the issues with which we grapple are issues that cover the recent occupation, but in the light of this long and, frankly, tragic historical association. Now, to help us address these questions, I think you've all got papers with fuller biographical notes. Let me just mention the panellists in order of their presentations. First will be Professor Rosemary Hollis, Professor of Middle East Policy Studies and Director of the Olive Tree Scholarship Programme at City University in London. And she was previously Director of Research and Head of Middle East Programme at Chatham House. Her most recent book is Britain and the Middle East in the 9/11 Era. Then we have Professor Ali Alawi, who is currently visiting Professor at the Middle East Institute in the University of Singapore. He was Iraq's Minister of Trade in 2003-04, Minister of Defence in April to June 2004, and Minister of Finance in 2005-06. So he knows whereof he speaks, and he also has historical interest in these subjects. He's the author, among other publications, of The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace, in 2008, and a forthcoming book, there are flyers outside for it, on Faisal I of Iraq, coming out from Yale University Press. Thirdly, we will have Charles Tripp, Professor of Politics with reference to the Middle East at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. Among his most recent publications are A History of Iraq, the third edition, and The Power and the People, Paths of Resistance in the Middle East, which came out earlier this year and is a very interesting account of the thinking behind the sense of the movement behind the Arab Spring, which itself, of course, has produced multiple and tragic consequences. And finally, we have Professor Nadia Al-Ali, who's Professor of Gender Studies, also at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. She's the founder of an organization, I think, called the Iraqi British Organization. It's an Iraqi British organization, Act Together, Women and Action for Iraq. Among her most recent publications are Iraqi Women, Untold Stories from 1948 to the Present, and a co-authored work, What Kind of Liberation? Women and the Occupation of Iraq. Ladies and gentlemen, I ask Rosemary Hollis to address us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. It's an honour to be on the opening panel, opening discussion for this, what promises to be an extremely interesting conference. The premise of my few remarks tonight is that to invade a foreign land and establish rule requires more than military power. It requires the confidence of power, self-confidence, if not self-righteousness, if you like. And this confidence and sense of righteousness is built upon the invader's understanding of what constitutes power and legitimacy in the day, the prevailing context, the prevailing era in history. That is my premise. I make two contentions, which are, first briefly, and then I'll elaborate a bit. Based on this assumption that you must have self-confidence and define that and understand it in terms of what defines power and legitimacy in the day. First, how power and legitimacy were understood in 1914 contrasts with how power and legitimacy were understood in 2003. And second proposition, the British framed the legitimacy and case for their two invasions, both to themselves and others, strictly in terms of what was understood as legitimate in the prevailing norms of the day. When I've said a little bit more about both of those, I then want to ask, what, if anything, makes the difference? Does it even matter? So, my proposition one. In 1914, and I would say through to 1940 at least, it was still the age of empires. Empires were the norm, and their legitimacy derived from their longevity and their ubiquity. Plus, contemporary theories of race and the prevailing mores or norms, which were, in Britain's case at least, based on religion and specifically Christianity. Nation and empire were intertwined, and elite status was not earned, it was ordained. Thus, we see that racism, privilege, social status or class, and national identity were all deployed to justify disparities of power, in the world and within any polity. The collective, in that sense, superseded the individual in 1914. By contrast, by 2003, the notions of racial equality, individual rights, human rights, social equality, self-determination, and rule by consent had become the basis upon which the legitimacy of power was judged. A considerable change in the context. Second proposition. The way the British framed and understood their invasion in 1914 reflected the norms of the day and contrasts with how they framed it and understood it in 2003. Thus, in 1914 to 20, the British elites, including Gertrude Bell, discussed amongst themselves the value and purpose of their rule in Iraq in terms of its usefulness to the British imperial enterprise, and asked themselves whether the attendant costs were justifiable accordingly. Hence you have Bell commending the way Churchill defined ways to contain the costs of maintaining British rule in Iraq so that these could be sustained. By contrast, in 2002-03, the context was the war on terror. But the ground was laid before that by Tony Blair and New Labour after their election in 97. New Labour came to power claiming that Britain was a young country. History was banished, over, irrelevant. As of 1997, New Labour also embarked upon a project to rebrand, that was the word, rebrand Britain as quoted in the Defence Review three times, to rebrand Britain as a force for good in the world, arguing that if Britain could be associated with standing up for commendable values like human rights, democracy, and confronting dictators, then the country would accrue a level of influence and reach in the world that was not attainable purely through material or economic power. There were no longer the same distinguished British elite figures of the ilk of Bell, Cox, Curzon, and Lawrence spearheading the imperial enterprise. Instead, there were grey-suited civil servants and uniformed generals scratching their heads about how to carry out a policy designed by politicians and advisers on the sofas of Number 10, men not necessarily born to power and privilege, who complicated the job of the civil servants and the military by insisting on keeping alive the fiction that Saddam Hussein could avert the invasion if he simply cooperated with UN weapons inspectors. The notion that the public had to be brought on board and the invasion debated in Parliament also complicated matters in a way that they had never been done in 1914 to 18. There was also the notion of trying to do the whole thing in accordance with international law and what that meant for diplomacy at the UN Security Council. Now, let me give one illustration of what difference or the contrast or illustration of what the contrast I'm describing here meant for the post-invasion situation in Iraq. In 1914, the British displayed their fascination with race and ethnicity in their fastidious documentation of every category of ethnic and sectarian subcommunity in Iraq, and that they displayed their fascination with race in the way in which their imperial servants managed to categorize and describe. And not only categorize, but characterize each of these new categories in ways that then determined the relative usefulness or reliability of these groups to the imperial enterprise. In 2003, by contrast, the Iraqis were broadly defined as either with the regime, the oppressors, or with the people, the oppressed. And then there was a huge debate and muddle about to what extent sectarian, Shia Sunni, and ethnic, Arab Kurd, differences should be taken into account in the organization of the new polity. And so to my concluding question, what difference did this contrast in the British narrative about their actions in 1914 and 2003 actually make? And I offer to start off the discussion after we've all spoken. I would suggest in terms of Iraqi suffering, not much. But in terms of the British, quite a lot. In terms of the contest between government and civil society to frame the national narrative.
The way that I would hope to approach this issue is perhaps in a non-conventional way. And that is to do with empire and the idea of empire. The idea of empire in and of itself is not evil. Iraq, of course, was part, or Mesopotamia was part of the Ottoman Empire. And I dare say if you ask the vast majority of people sometime around 1900 whether they thought of themselves as part of an national ethno-racial identity, they would say no. They were pretty content with being part and parcel of the Ottoman Empire. So if you look at the Ottoman Empire as a multi-ethnic, multinational, multi-sectarian unit, it seemed to have done its job in terms of accommodating the varieties of races and religions, particularly favoring the Muslims of the Near East. So there wasn't this great demand, there wasn't this great incentive to part and break up with this empire. And I dare say that the idea of empire in the Ottoman or in the Austrian, Austro-Hungarian sense is one that has shown its potency, I think, over the time. Seeing what has happened to the successor nation-state systems that evolved both in the Balkans and in the Middle East. In the Middle East right now, we're facing the collapse of the nation-state order that came out at the end of 1918. Every single state, Arab state, that emerged out of the wreckage of the Ottoman Empire is now either severely degraded or has, in fact, disappeared. And I think we have to ask ourselves whether this would not have been the condition where the idea of empire still prevalent. The Kingdom of Hejaz disappeared in 1925. Lebanon has been racked by civil war. Palestine has disappeared from the map. And Syria and Iraq, the other two successor states, are in deep, deep agony. So when Britain came in 1914, it came, we have to remember, as because of a world war. I doubt very much if the invasion and occupation of Mesopotamia would have been an independent act that would have been undertaken by the Foreign Office in order to gain imperial territory, were there not a world war. So you have to contextualize the occupation of Mesopotamia, which then turned into Iraq. So I'm not legitimizing the occupation of Iraq. All I'm saying is that it was part and parcel of a world war in which the Ottoman Empire foolishly declared itself on the side of the Central Powers. So Britain's occupation, its initial occupation, in terms of the laws of war, I don't think is an astounding fact. What was Britain's purpose in invading that territory? I think by and large it's to do with fitting Mesopotamia / Iraq into the imperial system, particularly built around Britain's presence in India, and to open up the lines of communications and to secure the Near East for the ease and speed of transport and communications to India. Oil, perhaps, but oil really wasn't on the cards in 1914. The fields that were well identified were not then in Iraq. There was very, very good indications that Iraq would have become a major oil producer. But let us not forget that oil in 1914 didn't have the same significance as it does now. Britain, when it took over that country, took over that territory, I think did, in the initial period, try to resolve the conundrum as to how to manage this terrain, which was composed of different groups and ethnicities that were not yet completely familiar with the national idea. And the idea of running the country directly or linking it to the Raj in India was mooted for a while, but then dropped in favor of what turned out to be the system of indirect control. That is, you run the country through the process of co-opting local elites while maintaining the pinnacles, the apex of power in the hands of those whom you appoint. A system that was to some extent designed because of the financial constraints on the country and because of the unwillingness of the British government at that point to deploy large military resources in the country to secure it. And this was especially true after the rebellion of 1920, which in Iraqi folklore has been turned into a kind of the first nationalist uprising against foreign rule, but in reality it was to a very large extent a tribal uprising of the Mid-Euphrates. And one of the reasons why it failed, not because of it was destroyed by British arms, failed because it did not have traction in nearly a very large part of the country. Britain ran Iraq through this process of indirect control, and if truth be told, the administrators who were placed there were, I must say, and history will confirm it, of the highest order in terms of their knowledge, their commitment, and in many cases their respect for the country and for the people. Entire areas of Iraq's administration owe themselves to the work of very, very committed and unsung heroes. And if you look at the names, they stand behind the founding of the modern Iraqi state. The entire educational system, the agricultural system, the works of the Ministry of Public Works, of Agriculture, were all set up through the dedicated efforts of these people. Again, I'm not trying to justify an imperial occupation. I'm just saying that you have to contextualize it and see it also in the light of building up the nation state. The nation state of Iraq in the 1920s was not built by Iraqi administrative talent. There wasn't such talent available. It was built by the work and effort of a large number of committed administrators, engineers, agronomists, educators, who spent a considerable amount of thankless time in building up the sinews of the Iraqi state. So we're talking about also an occupation that was handled with very limited resources. The entire budget of Iraq in 1925 didn't exceed the equivalent of £2 million sterling. And one of Britain's rules in managing these indirectly controlled mandates is to make sure that they were not a burden on Whitehall. The opposition, what was really the opposition to British rule? Here I'm talking about the mandate period in the first 12 years of the mandate. The real opposition came from the religious classes, in particular the Shia religious classes, who for a variety of reasons did not really want a national state. They wanted an Islamic state. So their opposition to British rule and to the form in which it was expressed was an opposition based on religious principles. And at the apogee, as it were, of the 1920 rebellion, word went out to the remnants of the Ottoman Caliphate to come back, all is forgiven. The other elements of the opposition in Iraq was easily co-opted. There were politicians who were on the make. Few of them were extremely committed. And here I would like to make an exception of a person like Ja'far Abu Timmen, who led the national opposition. But the majority of the others who were part of the so-called Effendi classes were easily co-opted. And they were there in order to position themselves to be co-opted into the political system. Britain's legacy also involved working with people, locals, as well as those who were brought in from outside, who had outstanding leadership qualities. Those who built the Iraqi state, of course, Faisal I, I think, stands at the top of this list. But you had people like Nuri Said, you had people like Ali Jodet, you had people like Ja'far al-Askari, who were extremely significant in building up the state. And they built it up not necessarily in opposition to British rule. They built it up in partnership. And their idea of the state was one in which Iraq was part of the Committee of Nations without necessarily taking on the strident nationalism that ended up in the kind of Iraq that we've had since the 1950s, an Iraq of upheavals and an Iraq of great many, many problems. The American occupation, on the other hand, is an entirely different affair. I can talk about that in the question and answer period. But it was, in many ways, a reverse image of what Britain confronted in 1914 to 1918. It left Britain's legacy, in short, was uneasy personal rule, with some outstanding political leaders, relatively strong state structures, but weak political institutions, and a history that was aggravated by violent upheavals. America's legacy is a dysfunctional state marked by a mediocre and venal political class with effective collapse of central power. I hope in the questions and answer period in the panel discussion I'll be able to elaborate more on this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Charles.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much also for your kind introduction and for including me on the panel. There's nothing more disagreeable for an audience than when all the panel agrees with each other, because what you really want is to get us working away at each other. It might work in the discussion, but I think that what I have to say isn't going to be very different from what the previous two speakers have said. But what I want to pursue in looking at the contrasts and comparisons between the two occupations of Iraq, and obviously one was a full-scale occupation by Britain and one was a mini occupation of a small portion of Iraq after 2003. But I think I want to draw a couple of parallels in terms of the legacies that they left behind, and in that sense, trying to think about the kind of structure of state that they left behind. And I would see that there is, despite what Ali has said about the differences of expertise, which I would certainly acknowledge, there is a strange parallel. And the parallel is partly due to the fact that, as I would argue it, these are the legacies of what I call liberal imperialism in both cases. Or I take what Rosie said, that these were thought of differently, but actually the logic is not very dissimilar. So if you think about the first occupation of Iraq by the British, and the creation of Iraq, indeed, by the British in 1914 onwards, on the one hand, there was a strong claim and indeed the rationale of the occupation, was to carry out a revolution from above. This was to create a state, to create a nation, to create a modern administration. There was a modernizing vision, in other words, of liberal imperialism underpinning the whole project. It was the system that underpinned the League of Nations mandates, and it was to be implemented through enlightened elites that were to be trained by the British and brought to the condition for self-government. It was, in other words, a British model of efficient, highly centralized bureaucratic power, which was shared by the modernizing Ottoman and Iraqi elites in the country itself. And behind that, it rather took second place, to say the least, there was a notion of a British ideal of a parliamentary democracy, constitutional monarchy operating on a Westminster model. So that, in a sense, was part of the ideal. And I take what Rosie said very much. That was the ideal of the time. This is what you do, and this is the vision of the mandates. But on the other hand, when you look at the actual operation of it, for all the expertise that Ali has talked about, you look at this was actually put into place by British political officers with what you could politely call a weak attachment to democracy as an ideal, but very strong views about ensuring order by so-called traditional elites and, if necessary, by violence. These were views bred in a ruthless empire that the British had, after all, been administering for some hundreds of years. They also brought with them, as Rosie said, colonial prejudices about the people they were administering, about the Iraqis, whether seen as Arabs, as Turks, as Kurds, or as Persians, as they still called them then, and a doubting that they could make democratic institutions work. So behind this, there was a curious double game going on. On the one hand, to create the trappings of the modern state, but actually not really believing that many of those within the state itself would be able to run it. And of course, when the Iraqis showed that they were perfectly capable of running with it and also standing up for their rights, they were dismissed as, one or rather tetchy imperial officer said, a nation of lawyers. In other words, Iraqis were actually standing up for their rights, and this isn't exactly what the British wanted here. So my argument is that this dual attitude gave birth to a dual state, a public state and a shadow state, a public state of public institutions, of parliaments, of elections, of bureaucratic regulations, of the judiciary, of constitutional monarchy. But behind it, a rather different kind of power, a shadow power based upon British-supported networks of association, of relation, of family, of local communities and notables largely accountable to Great Britain. And what that meant, effectively, was that the Iraqi state became a vehicle for power, for privilege, for wealth, for those who were in at the start. And that meant privileging the state servants, the army officers, the members of the Hashemite court, the new men who attached themselves to this new monarchy, but also the traditional leaders, the tribal sheikhs, both Shia and Sunni, and of course the notable families who'd been so prominent in 19th century Iraq under the Ottomans as well. But it also meant, and this was sinister for the future of Iraq, it became a mechanism for excluding those who were seen as untrustworthy. Most obviously, there was the Kurdish population. They were seen as troublesome, difficult to regulate, difficult to incorporate. And, of course, in 1931-32, when Britain and the Iraqi government recommended the independence of Iraq to the League of Nations, they cooked up a deal which effectively denied the Kurds their rights. For the Shia clerics, they were dismissed as fanatical, as obscurantist, as too far gone in terms of their admiration for what lay across the other side of the border, and therefore they were not to be counted as well. And equally, of course, for those Iraqis who are radical social reformers, who believed that the system of social justice was imperfect, that the land distribution was unfair, they too were to be dismissed as well. So in short, if you weren't recognized by the British as useful for the state project, as Rosie said, and for their kind of social order, then you were marginalized, written out of the dominant narrative of Iraqi politics. And if you get to the second occupation to see some of the parallels between the two, there is a strong echo of this in what happens after 2003. It's not an echo born of American admiration for British imperialism, but I would say it comes out of the logic of liberal imperialism itself and a very ambivalent reading of what Iraq was by the British and the Americans at the time. So on both sides of the Atlantic, in Britain and in the United States, there was clearly a preference to find people like us. In other words, a notion that once you remove Saddam Hussein, a free market democracy was in order. That is, in a sense, it would flower removing it. What it meant, of course, was a very thin reading of Iraqi political society. Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath were seen as the problem, but it was never really clear what they thought the problem was, and they certainly didn't do any research as to what that problem was. They also looked at Iraq through ethnic, through sectarian, and through tribal categories that may not have had much purchase at various times in Iraq or even then, but certainly did so after 2003. They were also intrinsically hostile to trades unions and to the organized working class in Iraq. Eager to open up markets, to exploit oil, it was not surprising that the same vision should have dismissed those who were standing up for workers' rights. And of course, at the same time, as these ideals of creating a liberal democracy, there was a temptation to actually recognize de facto local power networks. And one sees it in both British and American writings and memoirs, a kind of losing of patience with Iraqi politics, very similar to the 1920s, uneasy about the level of resistance and falling back, as we saw in 2006 onwards, on the patronage of militias. The Awakening Councils in Al-Bahr, the wonderfully named militias in Baghdad called Concerned Citizens by the United States, and the British doing deals with the Jaish al-Mahdi in Basra for a quiet life. And coming out of this, the encouragement of the rise of the present Prime Minister and System of Governments of Iraq, Nouri al-Maliki, effectively backing what was a weak central government to fight back. And Maliki showed that he was capable of doing so, but in doing so, I would argue, creates another form of the shadow state. The public institutions are there, the elections are there, the parliaments are there, the bureaucracy is reconstructed, but behind it, of course, is a network of power, influence, association, which are boosted by oil revenues, but of course by American at that stage, and also by Iranian support at the time. So again, Maliki showed that he was well able to counter his closest enemies, indeed his allies, and one of the areas he concentrated on was in the armed forces and in the intelligence services. It's familiar patterns to those who've watched the emergence of the dual state, the shadow state in Iraq. He enhanced his personal control through the office of the commander-in-chief, dismissing, transferring, promoting people. He controlled the Baghdad Brigade and, of course, used armed force very assertively to reassert the control of central power across Iraq in 2008, and with, of course, the proliferating intelligence services answering to the Prime Minister's office, many of whom were staffed by people from his own region. So what one has seen effectively is the re-emergence of the public state and the shadow state in Iraq. The shadow state, the networks of local loyalty and trust, new networks colonizing the ministries, public institutions with little authority and power, little public accountability, a feeling that real power lies outside parliament, and the national government's reach limited or confined to security agencies. And beyond that, of course, as one could ask many Iraqis, who trusts the national police? Who trusts the courts as public institutions? And finally, what do we know of the internal politics of the Iraqi army, which is now larger than when Saddam Hussein fell from power?
Thank you very much.
Right, I would like to shift focus now, as an anthropologist and women's rights activist, I'd like to shift focus to the more micro level of entanglement between Britain and Iraq, with a specific focus on women and gender relations. But my aim is also to complicate the entanglement in terms of political mobilization. I'd like to speak a little bit about my perception of how particularly the recent occupation has changed the political landscape in Britain. As you will notice, my talk is accompanied by a slideshow. I'm not going to speak to the pictures, but I'm trying for you to fill the gaps, visual gaps, in terms of one of the main points that I'm trying to address, which is that historically and very obviously in the context of the recent invasion and occupation of Iraq, we could observe this homogenization, generalization of the Iraqi and specifically Iraqi women. And what I'm hoping with the images and my talk is to, you know, try to challenge that. Clearly, you know, you might have sort of different interpretations of what you see, but there's certainly no doubt that what you see shows a variety of women. And I have to say, I've always, during the last decade or so, felt very challenged when people ask me, what do Iraqi women think? What do Iraqi women want? And I would say, what do British women want? What do British women think? And there seems to be sort of a perception that when you think about Britain or any Western country, you have people that are sort of complex and nuanced and diverse. But as you know, Charles already pointed out, when you think of Iraqis, before in the 90s it was just Saddam Hussein, and then we think of Iraqis in terms of their ethnic and religious backgrounds. Now, I think that when we look historically and also in more contemporary context, it's not only that there has been the tendency in terms of British public media and policy discourse to speak about Iraqi women in a sort of homogenized manner, but also, obviously, when we look both historically and contemporary ways, Iraqi women have been used to demarcate the boundaries between us versus them. There's a long history, and this has been widely documented in colonial and post-colonial studies, of what Gayatri Spivak called white men saving brown women from brown men. Of course, with respect to Gertrude Bell, it wasn't white men, and also it's quite complex, and we'll hear later, I know that on Friday there will be some papers speaking specifically about Gertrude Bell's relationship to the women's issue as an anti-suffragist herself. But that's not my point. I like to speak about Iraq and Iraqis here. And so there is a history of using women and gender relations as a marker between the civilized world and the uncivilized world. And women have been historically and more recently used as a justification for either colonialism or so-called liberation. And I think that I found it very peculiar that those of us who for many years, I mean during the 90s, were trying to raise consciousness in this country about human rights violations by the regime of Saddam Hussein, whether against the Kurds, against, you know, political opposition, and also gender-based violence, and no one wanted to listen. But no surprise, in 2002, Tony Blair became very interested in the women's issues and gender-based violence in Iraq as part of the wider interest, sudden interest in human rights issues. And that was, of course, much more pronounced in the United States. And when you look at my colleague Nicola Pratt and myself, we looked at the sort of rhetoric and the discourses just prior to 2003 and post-2003. And what was really interesting was there was this dichotomy. Women were either the victims of the previous regime and, you know, therefore sort of instrumentalized as a form of justification. But women were also the midwives. That was actually the terminology used of the new Iraq. Women were very much symbolic in giving birth to the new Iraq. Paul Wolfowitz, then Deputy Secretary of Defense, wrote in 2005, Iraqi women were helping give birth to freedom in the post-Saddam order. So in the post-invasion period, the image of the heroic Iraqi women appeared with regularity in the media. And I have to say that now, going closer to home here in Britain, what I found very disheartening that in the initial period after the invasion in 2003, 2004, up to 2005, there was lots of funding, lots of thinking, you know, in terms of women's project, women's empowerment, women's rights, and I was often asked to get involved in various projects. But post 2005, when the whole discourse, and I think that is historically has been an important aspect, the shift from human security to national security, and women and gender issues totally dropped off the agenda. Who wants to speak about women's rights when we discuss the status of Kirkuk or the status of federalism or oil. And so, and what I have, I find quite disappointing and frustrating is the short-sightedness of what I thought were good initiatives in this country, not only with respect to, you know, women's rights, women's issues, women's empowerment. Whether these programs were well-researched is another issue. I think there were many of these projects were problematic because people hadn't done their homework, they hadn't actually looked into the specific needs. But there were some good ideas in some projects, but also with respect to other issues like education. For instance, I was part of the British Council-funded Delphi project, which was linking British universities and Iraqi universities. And we were supposed to have several rounds, and then the project was cut short because now all the funding has to go to Egypt and Tunisia. And I think that is really very problematic, and in my view, it's a real shame. However, I would like to, coming back to women, I think it's really important to stress that it's not only British politician or American politicians who have instrumentalized women, but I think it's also important to stress that it's been Iraqi politicians as well. And I think one of the things in terms of a more post-colonial manner of analyzing situation is to recognize the complicity of local elites. And so as much as, for instance, in Islamist politicians have been using women to demarcate the difference to the previous regime, which was largely secular, and women and gender are the most symbolic way to actually symbolize the difference to the previous regime. The resistance to the occupation and the invasion have also been using women and gender, whether it's respect of controlling dress code, controlling mobility, specific laws. I'm thinking particularly about the laws, the personal status code, which is governing marriage, divorce, and child custody. These have been used to also resist Western cultural encroachment. And then on the secular side, there has been lip service paid, and I think in some ways it has been used positively. I think that certainly when we look at Iraq today, the KRG, the Kurdish-controlled region, I think there's much more of a political will to look at women's rights. But I think there's also the element of distinguishing itself from the central government. And I think that in terms of a more secular, liberal democratic politics, the issue of women is very centrally used here. Now, finally, I'd like to also say that in terms of political mobilization, as someone who has been living in this country for a long time, and I was involved in the anti-sanctions movement in the 90s, and what I think has been very interesting for many of us of Iraqi origin is the way that, of course, the anti-imperialist politics, I'm thinking here particularly about the anti-war movement and the left, in the name of fighting imperialism and its own government, I think has often been very blind, actually, or very sort of one-sided in terms of, certainly in the 90s, I found glossing over human rights violations of the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. So I think many of us have felt uncomfortable trying to, be part of wider political movements in this country, but at the same time being critical of dictatorships and authoritarian regimes, and this, the sort of the enemy of your enemy is not necessarily my friend position is often a quite difficult position to be in. Finally, I'd just like to take the opportunity to thank the British Academy. I think many of us working on the Middle East, and particularly Iraq, would not have been able to do our research if it wasn't for the help of the British Academy. And I want to stress that specifically because I'm also very much in contact with colleagues in the States, and although there might be more funding available in the States, one of the things that so far, and I really hope it will stay this way, has been really very positive in Britain is that I personally have never felt that I have to censor what I'm saying, whether it's to my students or you know, in a public event, which is not the same with many of my colleagues working in the States and working on similar issues. And I am worried as things develop right now, and I'm worried also in terms of the impact of austerity on British academy. Having said this, I think one of the important elements right now in terms of looking at the relationship and entanglements between Britain and Iraq is education. I mean, for me, as an anthropologist, democracy is not election. Democracy is political culture, decision-making, you know, how we talk and discuss with each other, and education plays such an important role. And I've been working very closely over the last few years with CARA, the Council for Assisting Refugee Academics, which has been very instrumental in helping Iraqi academics, both in Britain, but also in the Middle East and in Iraq. And I think it's really important to keep these relations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you will all appreciate the way in which our speakers have spoken to fundamental issues and have stuck to time, two things that aren't easily combined. While you're thinking of questions you would like to ask, perhaps I can slip in one myself. Several of the presentations, including the last one, but actually all in one way or another, raised but didn't delve into, for lack of time, no doubt, the question of, as it were, was this a United States occupation this time round rather than a UK one? And should we be thinking of it in slightly different terms? And I'm very struck that the debate about Iraq in the United States was fundamentally different from that in the United Kingdom. For example, it is inconceivable, at least to me, that Parliament could have agreed a resolution, as the both the House of Representatives and the Senate did in, I think, 1998, but anyway, well before the invasion, called the Liberation of Iraq Act, which solemnly promised to liberate Iraq. We just don't seem to be in the business of passing that kind of resolution in this country. And behind it, of course, there was, in fact, breathing through almost every word of that act, a strong sense that the dispensation of democracy, the issue you've mentioned, democratic elections and so on, would itself completely transform the environment in Iraq. Which leads to the question, which I ask really of any and all our panellists, perhaps starting with you, because you touched on this particularly. What is the difference between the American conception of occupation and that of the United Kingdom? And did the UK actually make any useful contribution in the planning of this last 10 years of occupation of Iraq?
Are we talking about the first or the second occupation? The second one. No, I think the second one, there's no doubt it was American-led. The whole thing was designed and was orchestrated and was managed by the United States. And I think Britain, for all of its, was really just there for the ride. The role of Britain inside Iraq after the occupation was really marginal. The resources that they had available to them compared to that of the United States were really insignificant. You may have spent maybe £2 or 3 billion on the war. The United States, if everything is taken into account, figures reach $1 trillion. So we're talking about different scales. Britain tried to act sort of as Athens to America's Rome, but it didn't really work out. That went for a few months, and then with Greenstock left, and that was about the end of it. They worked in tandem as much as possible, but it was very much an American affair. And I think whatever Britain did was to perhaps moderate certain exaggerated tendencies on the part of the U.S. administration and the U.S. CPA, which was the US-led coalition provisional authority. On the military side, I think they were fully integrated under American command. So, if, you know, if truth be told, it was a very secondary and minor role. In fact, it's Britain's involvement in the occupation of Iraq second time round is really just a shadow on people's minds. It's not there. It doesn't have any reality.
Nadia.
Yeah, I just want to give an example in terms of who were the people who were sent to Iraq to work on women's issues. I think that sort of illustrates some of the differences. So the U.S., in the U.S. context, the people we interviewed, my colleague Nicola Pratt and myself, were women who, most of the women we interviewed had never left the United States prior to going to Iraq, had never been involved in any kind of development, post-colonial reconstruction work, were actually not, were, if anything, were not feminist. Their main qualification was that they were Bush loyal. Now, in the British context, the two women who were sent specifically with a gender hat on, whether you know you were in favor of them going or not, I mean, these were people who were had long history of working in the context of women's rights activism, post-conflict reconstruction, and what they told me, I mean, I was very sort of myself skeptical about their involvement, but I had lots of sympathy for them when they afterwards told me what they tried to do in terms of negotiating with their US counterparts. And they were extremely, I should say, frustrated and disillusioned because they were dealing with people who had no idea either about Iraq, but also comparatively other contexts about women's issues.
Thank you.
Only to say that I was struck at the time of the invasion, Arabs around the region were saying things to me that gave me the impression that they thought that the British knew the Middle East and that somehow it's passed down generation to generation and that therefore that the British would know better what to do in Basra than the Americans in Baghdad. And I said, if they do, it'll be on the as a result of urban guerrilla warfare in Northern Ireland or the Balkans, but it won't be as a result of knowing anything about the Arab world. And it's interesting because it was a reminder to me that generation after generation in the Middle East does pass down the information. It's probably old information about the British that they know us in some sometimes rather alarming ways. They don't anymore. And I couldn't get that message across. And I remain constantly stuck to get the message across that what is happening in the Middle East is not because the British or Americans want it to happen. What they want to happen in the Middle East is quite often not what is happening, but this sense that they must want it because it's happening. And I dare say that is a legacy of the first invasion of Iraq.
Just a brief sort of personal vignette on of how well prepared the British were and whether they'd done their homework for what they saw as the occupation of even a small part of Iraq was that I was contacted about 3 weeks before, a little way before the invasion, by the chief legal officer of the British Expeditionary Force, who was contacting me from Kuwait, and who said that he'd been told nothing at all about the Iraqi legal system. Could I recommend any books about the Iraqi legal system? I said, yes, I've got plenty here. These are the ones you should have a look at, about the structure of law in Iraq, about the structure of the legal system, about the judiciary. And he said, he'd been told nothing at all, nothing at all. And so I recommended him these books, and a few months later, he contacted me again and said that he was very grateful for what he'd read, but he was quite taken aback by the fact that when he got to Basra, the head of the Basra Bar Association came to see him. He said, we had no idea there was a bar association in Basra. So there was a kind of, what were they expecting to find? He said the one thing that did worry him and reassure him is that when he got to Basra prison, which had been systematically looted, the only thing that hadn't been looted were these huge metal gates which said Made in Sheffield, 1935. And it gave him a kind of boost.
Questions? Yes, gentlemen there.
If you could identify yourself first.
Yeah. Subi al-Azawi, of Iraqi origin, obviously. An architect. May I say the difference between the two invasions is that the 1914-18 was an occupation of development and building. They built the first university, schools for boys and girls, the ministries, houses of parliament, various pumping stations for oil later on. And therefore, I think they really have put the foundations for a new state of Iraq. And obviously, they wanted this new state of Iraq to be as close to Britain as possible. The invasion of 2003, which I would call the third invasion, because there was a 1991 invasion. 91 invasion and 2003 invasions were invasions of destructions, deliberate destructions to bring Iraq back into the Middle Ages. I remember one US pilot said on his bombing mission to Baghdad, he said, I have just come from Baghdad. Baghdad is lit like a Christmas tree. And then he said, we have bombed Iraq back to the Middle Ages. Now, Christmas tree is really a religious connotation, and therefore this is part of the Crusader War. The other thing, I disagree with Dr. Allawi about the oil, because in 1914, Churchill changed the Royal Navy ships from being coal-based into oil-based. And this is because there was oil in Abadan itself. And may I say about the weapons of mass
destruction? I must ask you to be very brief and just get to a
question. This point is going to horrify everyone. Iraq was invaded because of weapons of mass destruction. Recently, the European Union and the Iraqi government agreed to dump nuclear waste into Iraq. And that is incredible. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that's a question.
I don't have a question or an observation.
Well, it's an observation for you, I think.
Well,
I was speaking because my family built Iraq from the middle of the second half of the 19th century to the middle half of the 20th century, producing 12 master builders over 5 generations.
Thank you. Professor Alava.
Well, in as much as there's a question embedded in your comments, I do agree with you that it was, I won't call it an occupation of building and development, but I think the nature of the imperial project in Iraq involved that, as it involved wherever they went throughout the world. If you look at what was built in India, an entire new capital was built in India. If you look at what was done in Malaysia, the same thing. So there was a very, very strong element of building the institutions of a modern state. Now, the fact that there was also an underlying agenda to it, I don't think it's really that astounding. I mean, if you're going to invest time and effort in order to bring a society and a culture into your orbit, you would expect it to be entwined or ensnared in your long-term plans and schemes. This is another matter. This is, the political aspect of occupation. But in terms of the development that was undertaken in Iraq in the 1920s and building the foundations of a nation state is really formidable. And I find it extraordinary that people do not really acknowledge that because of their hatred or embarrassment of imperialism. The imperial idea worked very, very well in countries or in territories where the people were treated equally. The problem with the British Empire, in my mind, is not that the imperial idea was wrong, is that they treated the people of the empire differentially. That was a problem. And the problem with the American empire is that it's an empire that refuses to acknowledge it's one and hides behind the language and the discourse, as it were, of democracy and rights and freedoms because it refuses to acknowledge that it is an empire of power. Britain, Lawrence had the idea that the Arabs would be the first, quote-unquote, brown dominion. If you take out the racial aspects of it, if Britain treated its empire in that way, which was, by the way, a very Gandhian proposition. Gandhi himself believed in empire, if it was an empire of equals. But it was betrayed. So to me, Britain is an imperial idea which betrayed itself. America is an imperial idea which denies itself.
At the back, on the right there. Yep.
Yeah, hello, thank you very much. I'm Haider Rida from Bain & Company. With my question, I would like to move to today, after the occupation. So I agree that there were three occupations. I would say first the British, then the Ba'ath Party, who destroyed the country mentally and materially, and afterwards the American occupation. But now that we've had these three occupations, which role can Britain play in building Iraq back up, both the British government, but even more so, I would like to hear the view from the panel on how the British public can play a role in that, through institutions, through NGOs, even through investment from BP in the oil industry, whatever ideas you have, which role can we play in building Iraq back up after these three occupations? Thank you very much.
Rosemary, is that for you?
You're talking about what more can be done to revive, rebuild, rejuvenate Iraq now? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. I was wondering what the British public, the British civil society, can do to help Iraq become a normal country again. If we say that Britain played such a good role during the first occupation, now in a different century, I think we can even do more in different ways probably, but I would like to hear the view from the panel on which ways that are that the British civil society can play a role in building Iraq. Thank you.
I think you've had hints at some of the answers from all of us, because Nadia, for example, talks about how some of the people in the humanitarian aid agencies and development agencies have some sense of working with shattered communities, disrupted communities, and what might be the priorities in working with them. And in that sense, Iraq is as deserving a case as any for the work of the international humanitarian aid agencies. In terms of education, British Council, I mean, the whole of Friday's of this conference is in danger of being a tragedy in terms of what's been lost to the collection in Iraq. And I think there would be British Iraqis and non-Iraqi British who would love to put an effort into rebuilding in that respect in Iraq, but the problem will be money. Big problem will be money. And I personally am very suspicious of some of the other types of initiatives. Most of all, I'm suspicious of so-called democracy training. I think it's nonsense, mostly. Scholarships is what's needed, and opportunities for Iraqis to travel and to study abroad and to learn what they want to learn, as opposed to being told by foreigners what to do. I'm just despondent that, A, there is not a large number of people with the amount of care and interest in Iraq to do it. I wouldn't look to business to be the answer. And there is so many other calls on the British taxpayers' money, not least the Syrian refugees now, that I wouldn't hold out too much hope that an old relationship is going to come to the rescue.
Nadia.
And money can be a curse as well. It's a very double-edged sword. I mean, it creates sort of cultures of dependency, and corruption has been really rife, including within civil society. But I think what I suggest is that rather than sending the British gender advisor to Iraq to show Iraqi women, you know, how to attain women's empowerment and women's rights, to actually take the Iraqi women's organization, women's rights organization, seriously. You saw some images. I mean, Iraqi women have been marching, some of the Iraqi Women's League, the picture you saw in the 60s has been on the street. There's a long history of women's NGOs. There's right now, despite all the turmoil and the violence, there's still an Iraqi women's network of over 80 organizations across the country who are involved in humanitarian work, but also in advocacy and lobbying. Work with those organizations rather than just impose your agenda of what should be done. And I think that cuts across, whether it is with respect to women and gender issues, whether it's respect to issues around human rights more broadly. And I think that money is important, and I do think that it is a shame that the whole international donor system is very short-sighted and attention span is very limited, where the crisis goes, the money goes, and then we cut the funding, and so projects are not sustainable. But at the same time, I think it's really important we are very careful to not recreate cultures of dependency. And I think what is really important right now is partnerships of capacity building. And I mean, as someone working in education, that's where I've been putting my focus, but there are lots of different ways one can get involved.
Thank you. Can I just say, I mean, I think it's very appropriate that British Institute for the Study of Iraq, which is the sponsor of this organization, this event and tomorrow's conferences, is trying to do that in a small way, in different ways. And one is partly through partnerships, through education, training, assisting Iraqis to come here to train them in skills, archaeology, cultural preservation, cultural heritage. A lot of it exactly to do with the cooperation with Iraqi institutions as well. Maybe in that sense, although we're trying to raise money to be able to do more of it, maybe part of that is the shortage of funders is a virtue, because it means that we don't go in with a large purse, as it were, to dispense good things that we see coming from ourselves, but actually we're talking to Iraqis, creating networks in the educational institutions, in the archaeological and the cultural heritage areas. And these, I think, are hugely important. Again, one of the problems is that the sort of hard power, the realist power of oil, of security, tends to push that out of the way. But in fact, if you forget your history, as Adam suggested, you're in real trouble. And so one of the things, clearly, is to remind ourselves of our history, but also, in a sense, collaborate with Iraqis in the preservation of their own.
I'll just make a quick answer. One is a small point. I think the British government here should make more visas much more easily available for Iraqis to come here. And this is really an issue. This applies across the board. And I think no matter what they do, it's next to impossible for a person who doesn't have, you know, £50,000 in the bank to come here. The other thing, which is much more serious, is that the Iraqi state is nearly being destroyed by the level of corruption in the country. And I'm talking about industrial level corruption. And it applies to the entire political class. Maybe 2%, I would exclude them. So 98% of the Iraqi political class is corrupt. And by corrupt, I mean they take from the public treasury, and a lot of it ends up in London. And if the British government is serious about stopping illegal, illegitimate capital flight, amassing of illegal fortunes that end up in London real estate, I think they should do something about it here, because billions of Iraq's money that has been looted sits in either in UK bank accounts or in London property or in British stocks. And if you highlight these things, it might begin the process of reforming our horrible political culture.
Time is marching on, and I think what I will do is take three interventions now and then ask each of our speakers to respond as they may to them, starting with you.
My name is Wasan Alam. I'm the health attaché to the Iraqi embassy. And the main role, this is a new established office, the main role is to link up with the universities. And what we have now is funding for 600 scholarships. But the main obstacle is finding these placements here in the UK. It's not easy to get that number. And if we can get priorities, for example, for Iraqis, that would be a fantastic opportunity to establish these links. So a fast track into the universities here, into the colleges, Royal Colleges, the
all of that will help Iraqis. So the problem of funding is solved, and I don't think this is a big opportunity for both countries, I think.
Thank you. Gentleman here in the center aisle.
My name is Keith Nuttall. I was in business. I was extremely puzzled by Professor Hollis's statement just now that business shouldn't play a role in this. I'm afraid I must disagree entirely. Business is absolutely core to this, because British companies getting involved in Iraq, training Iraqis for the future, working with Iraqi colleagues for the future, is surely a core part of the rebuilding of the Iraq that we all want to see. And my own experience of being in Iraq very recently was that many Iraqis still have good memories, partially for the reasons you've touched on, of training in the UK, business that they did with the UK years ago. I think that absolutely is a core part of what needs to be done to rebuild Iraq.
And then there's a gentleman, a lady back with holding up a paper. That's right. One row further back. She's there.
My name is Beauty Fraser. I recently went to a lecture in the British Academy on the desalination of the marshes, and also a scientific project where palm trees, in fact, were the project was to make them salt, not compliant, but help. In other words, another project, a scientific project, to enhance the production of what's a very important date export from Iraq, which I was told at the time had a very high percentage of the GPN for Iraq. Now, this kind of project surely is something that should be encouraged, and we haven't heard much about it tonight. And I agree with this gentleman who just spoke that business is very important, and projects linking up with big business in Iraq is an important point to make. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm conscious that there are many others whose hands are raised, but I'm going to have to draw a line there and ask our panellists to respond to these three last issues that have been raised. I don't know if you want to start, Rosemary.
Okay. I can see how I'm easily puzzling you about business. It is as a result of the way things have gone in Iraq in particular. I was aghast. The approach to rebuilding Iraqi industry and production, and in particular the energy sector, straight after the invasion, appalled. And this is principally the Americans' fault. And there were Iraqis in exile who, between them, came up with a wonderful scheme for oil ownership that would make the industry not the corrupt coffers of the state or a small elite, but a national project on which there would be lots of cooperation needed with the international companies, and that this could work well. They hadn't a hope, because their attitude, their plans were far too equitable and far too much in the interests of the Iraqis. And I'm afraid the British are guilty a little bit of this, but the Americans do it in spades. Whenever a country needs rebuilding, they preach free market capitalism as the answer, and that means they win. And their relationship with the locals in a place like Iraq now would be a corrupt one. So I meant, initially when I said money is part of the problem, I didn't mean the big money that's going in and fueling corruption. I didn't mean the big money that would go in with, for example, a major construction project which would be guarded by security guards and which would only go ahead as a result of bribing certain locals rather than others, and would become a game in itself as opposed to rebuilding exercise. I meant the exercises that require exchange visits, that require placements, that would enable the Iraqis to simply finance the trips to get what they want. That's what I meant there was a shortage of money for. It's small-level stuff, but on across the board that's needed. And I would conclude by saying I'm interested in knowing whether visas are the main problem for the getting the placements that you're talking about, because the business I've had with getting some Palestinians into my university this year is worse than ever, because the universities have raised the bar for what qualifications you have to have in place, and the UK Border Agency will not touch an application until the university has vouched that this applicant has everything, including all the money they need for all the fees and all the living expenses, and they've got the top scores in the English language tests, and on and on, and then that they will go home afterwards. Is it, you're nodding your head, is it principally about visa issues? Okay, but it could be the training colleges and universities are deterred by what they have to guarantee to the government that the student will not become an illegal immigrant.
I think obviously business can play a central part in developing the country and upgrading its skills and improving the technology transfer. And so on. But you have to have an enabling environment, which doesn't really exist right now in Iraq. If you exclude the oil industry and exclude the northern areas of the KRG in Kurdistan, direct foreign investment in Iraq is non-existent. I mean, I'm not trying to undermine the work, the sterling work of the National Investment Commission, but that's the fact of the matter. You can't really affect people if you sit in houses like that are built like fortresses and surrounded by heavily armed bodyguards who, every time you take a trip outside of your compound, it costs your company £2,000 or £3,000. It's just not on. So the first rule of business affecting or turning or helping the country to develop and becoming a real engine of growth, as it were, is to create the enabling environment for it. And this is not on. I think one of the reasons that people look fondly, as it were, I mean, maybe through this patina of time, for this 1920s period, is that you had very substantial British corporate presence in Iraq. One of the first companies there was the Lynch Brothers Tigris and Euphrates Navigation Company. And then you had the Nairn Company. People still talk about the cross-desert transport of the Nairn Company. If you talk about commodities dealing. Iraq was one of the world's largest barley exporters, which was handled by a Scottish company called Andrew Ware. Gray McKenzie had a presence there, a very large presence there. It was an open economy that was accommodating, that was liberal, and that was quite accepting of foreign investors. And they came in and built the African and Eastern Company, which has a very illustrious history in Iraq. It's now part of Unilever, or Lever Brothers. Generations of managers came out of that, and they provided the core, as it were, of the Iraqi business community. This doesn't exist anymore. If Unilever doesn't go and invest, if Nestle doesn't do it, if I don't know, Ford or General Motors or Honda or whatever, there's no way in which the benefits of business involvement can be transferred to the local. So the enabling environment, I'm afraid, has to be created. Otherwise, it's just trade. And it's a question of selling and making your margins under sometimes very difficult collection conditions. So it's a high-risk environment with high returns, but necessarily so.
Oh, just following up on what has already been said on the issue of visas, and I really very much appreciate your plea. And I think, often we think, so what can we do? What can we do to help Iraq and Iraqis? And I think, for those of you sitting in the room, I think you can do a lot in terms of trying to influence the public discourse about immigration in this country, which, frankly speaking, I find quite worrying. I mean, the whole issue of visas and that it's so difficult for foreign students to come is part, of course, of a wider debate now about asylum seekers and immigration and students being used as a way to get down the numbers. And I think that it is
very worrying to me that, you know, even Labour is very much now on the bandwagon, and I think that is something that we can all play a role in actively in this country.
Thank you. Yes, briefly, I think that what we've heard this evening is, in a sense, two indictments of short-termism in two areas. One, Ali Alawi was very eloquent in talking about the short-termism in the Iraqi government administration. You think you're going to be in the job for a very short time, you make as much money out of it as you can, and you don't really care about the consequences. And even those who pretended that they were reconstructing Iraq, what did they really see beyond 4 years or 5 years? So there is a sense of the short-termism in government in Iraq, which I think breeds the kind of corruption that we heard about. But of course, business as well, in a sense, one has to be careful about the short-termism of business. There are clearly businesses who want to invest in Iraq, and in a sense, those are the ones one wants to see investing, not just in Iraq as a place to earn profits, but Iraq as human resources, as a place that will be there for a long time to come and which we'll have a long relationship with. But many of the businesses, as we know, go in, come out, make as much money as they can, pay off people here. So there is business in business. And clearly, for the kinds of things we've been talking about, scholarships, assisting in fundraising for modest but hugely important human networks of cooperation in culture, in education, and so on, one does need to interest businesses. But one of the things that, for instance, the British Institute for the Study of Iraq has discovered is it's quite difficult to persuade businesses that this is something they should be investing in. And so, in a sense, one of our tasks is to try and say this does have a long-term payoff. And occasionally you get the enlightened people who think about that, but otherwise not. And, of course, one only has to leave you with the kind of terrible, tragic tale of British business enterprise, which could be lauded on one level, but actually had lethal consequences in Iraq and the other, which, of course, the man who flogged millions of pounds worth of golf ball detectors as so-called explosive detectors, still being used even 6 months ago in the streets of Baghdad by the police as they waved these bits of plastic at cars to see if they had explosive. And, of course, it didn't have any effect at all. And we've seen the horrendous consequences of relying on such outrageous forms of corrupt enforcement.
Well, I hope that bogus explosive detectors aren't a perfect symbol of British policy in relation to Iraq in two occupations. They get a bit close to the bone, though. I have to say, I think this has been, as it ought to be in relation to the subject, a sober and a sobering discussion, a remarkably well-informed one. I want to thank you all for your participation and for the questions, which were all very much to the point and well expressed. I want, if I may, to offer a particular word of thanks to Joan Porter McIver, who is here, who has been the mainstay of the British Institute for the Study of Iraq, brackets Gertrude Bell Memorial, unbracket, and for organising not just this event, but also the conference that's going to take place in the next 2 days. And I hope in thanking our speakers, you'll also give her a round of applause, and then we can go on to drinks next door. Thank you very much.
I won't keep you for your drinks for more than 30 seconds. My name is Eleanor Robson. I'm the chair of the council of the British Institute for the Study of Iraq. Before we go next door, first of all, I want to thank you for coming, for listening, for questioning, and I hope for continuing the discussion. I'd like to thank our hosts here tonight, the Royal Society, and all the many staff who've been involved in making this such a successful occasion. To thank our co-organisers at the British Academy, and particularly to Sir Adam for his erudite and perfectly judged chairing of the event. You've already thanked our panellists, but we can thank them again once more. I'm looking forward to seeing many of you tomorrow morning for the continuation of the conference, if you already have a ticket. If you don't, I'm afraid we've been fully booked for months now. But everyone is welcome to join us for a drink and continued conversation now. Thank you all very much indeed.